Today at Reader's Corner, Charles Fountain, author of The Betrayal, the 1919 World Series and the Birth of Modern Baseball. I'm Bob Custer. Welcome to Reader's Corner. Nearly a century ago, the Chicago White Sox faced the Cincinnati Reds in the 1919 World Series. The games attracted big crowds, widespread enthusiasm, and plenty of action from the so-called sporting men, who placed bets on who would win each contest. Gambling was an integral and accepted part of baseball at the time, but for this series, something seemed off. The White Sox were heavily favored to win, but they lost to the Reds 5-3. Speculation quickly surfaced that the series had been rigged. When the dust settled, 8 White Sox players, known from then on as the Black Sox, were accused of throwing the games. Charles Fountain tells the riveting story of one of baseball's most notorious scandals in his book, The Betrayal, the 1919 World Series and the Birth of Modern Baseball. Mr. Fountain teaches journalism at Northeastern University in Boston and is the author of 3 previous books, including Under the March Sun, The Story of Spring Training. Today we're featuring an encore edition of our interview with Mr. Fountain. He joins us via Skype for this interview. Charles Fountain, welcome to Reader's Corner.
Bob, thanks very much. It's great to be here.
Well, why is this incident the birth of modern baseball? Tell us what changed as a result of it.
Well, baseball was sort of a loose confederation of independent organizations in its early days, that the owners were men of varying degrees of wealth, that you had some very wealthy individuals, you had some people that were just barely scraping by off the money they made off ticket sales and program ads. And there was no central administration that was looking after the good of the game. You had 16 individuals looking after their own personal interests. And that was never going to benefit the game. And what the Black Sox did was force baseball to recognize that this sort of management system wasn't working in a modern game. And they needed to bring in a strong central authority. And that was the hiring of Judge Landis.
And that's Kennesaw Mountain Landis. Wasn't that his name that he went by?
That was his name. He was the most famous jurist in America. In a largely anonymous profession, Judge Landis was famous. He had made headlines back in 1907 when he fined John D. Rockefeller $29 million for violations, his company's violations of the Antitrust Act. That made headlines from coast to coast and made Landis a household name, which he pretty much remained for the 10 or 15 years after that before being brought into professional baseball. He had also had some rulings on baseball cases, which led the owners to believe that he would be a man that was sympathetic to their interests and would be good for the game.
So in a sense, he's the prototype baseball commissioner that we have today, would you say?
He is the prototype of the modern commissioner, yes, yeah. And he is also the last of his kind. There has been no commissioner since Judge Landis in any sport that has held that kind of power. And, you need look only to the doings of the Tom Brady, Roger Goodell Deflategate story compared with the way that Judge Landis handled the Black Sox to know that the role of commissioner has changed dramatically.
And we're going to get to that. But before we leave the game in the early part of the 19th century, what fascinated me about your book, and it's also something I saw watching Ken Burns, the Jackie Robinson special just recently, and then the baseball that he did. There's 15 CDs that I happen to own, and I've watched every one of them. And what's amazing is the different culture. First of all, everybody is dressed up like they're going to Sunday school. I mean, they're in, all the men have their hats on. I guess the women do too. They're in suits. They're in ties. I don't see anybody eating in any of those those films either. And my gosh, today you go to a ballpark, half the fun is the eating and the drinking. And help us understand how different the culture was in those days. You might also comment on a really negative part of that culture, the gambling, which really, again, blew me away from reading your book.
First of all, about the culture and the environment, that people came to baseball games to see a baseball game. People come today for the experience. People talk about the cost of seeing a baseball game. In 1919, they would have talked about the 50-cent cost of a ticket. Maybe they bought a beer for a nickel or a dime. Today, the people talk about the cost of a family of four going to a ball game, includes ticket prices, parking, a souvenir, a pizza, or a something else from the concession stands, beers for the parents, and sodas for the kids. And it's all part of a whole experience today that didn't exist then. It was a much simpler world. There were no ballpark souvenirs in those days. There were no souvenir stands. There was a concession stand. It would have had very simple fare, and only a small fraction of the fans would have probably patronized it in those days. It was a much simpler world on every front. The other piece of it, as you hint, is that betting was openly a part of the culture of baseball in those days. And you had the culture of betting going along with the culture of sport in those days. But in baseball, what it meant was that not only were there bets between the teams, in other words, the teams in the early days of the game, we're talking the 1860s, 1870s, the teams would gather and they would determine what they were going to bet on the game. You know, we've collected $50, we've collected $75. Do you go up? Do we go down? That was a part of the game. That was basically the purse that the early players played for. As fans started taking part of that, they bet on their team. It was a sign of loyalty to your team to bet on it. And it didn't take too long for the bettors to figure out that if they bet a lot of money, if they had someone in the tank on one team or the other, they could increase their odds of winning that. So you had game-fixing scandals as far back as the end of the Civil War. The first story that I found about game-fixing came 5 months after the close of the Civil War in 1865. In the 1870s, there was a word that would have been known to every baseball fan in America. The word was hippodroming. Hippodroming is defined as the playing of a contest, the outcome of which has been prearranged. And what it meant was that if the word hippodroming appeared in a story, it meant that the writers had reason to believe or suspect that certain players had agreed to throw that game for the benefit of the gamblers. It was something that concerned the owners with the organization of the National League in 1876. They made it a priority, and by the late 1870s, they had drummed a number of players out of the game. And, you know, it had held that for the 1880s and 1890s, the game was rather quiet. With the coming of the American and National Leagues, the new modern game in 1901, and this, as I said, loose confederation of individual owners ruling the game, the door was open for gambling to come back in. Gambling had never been far away, but it was kept in the shadows in the 1870s and 1880s. But with the new century, the gamblers became ever more brazen. And the reason is that they could, that the owners didn't like the gamblers, didn't like rumors of gambling, didn't like rumors that their game may not be honest. But as bad as rumors were for the game, the only thing that would have been worse was proof. So the owners didn't go looking too hard for any proof of gambling scandals in the early years of the game. And what that meant was that the gambling scandals became ever more common and became ever more pronounced. The wonder of the 1919 World Series story is not that it happened, but that it took so long to happen. It's amazing that this didn't happen a decade earlier.
Well, let's talk a little bit about the players. One of the things that comes through for me in the book is when you look at the power or lack thereof the players had in those days compared to today, whether it's their enormous salaries or whether it's the players' union. I think the best example of that is the fact that you still have these players walking around on the field during games with chewing tobacco in their mouth. And, of course, you'd think if there was any kind of a strong baseball commissioner that wanted to send a message to young baseball players, they would have outlawed that a long time ago. But it's basically, from what I can tell, the players' union that reigns supreme. And back in the day, back in those days of the formation of the National League, at that time, the owners decided a reserve clause made a lot of sense. Help our listeners understand that reserve clause. Of course, Kurt Flood challenged it years and years later, and eventually the reserve clause went away. But for now, for the purposes of the betrayal and the year of 1919, that reserve clause held enormous power over these players and, in a sense, kept them in their place.
The reserve clause, which was the financial foundations of the game for 75 years, dates till the first years of the National League, when the league was expanding and teams were hiring away players from other teams. And the escalating salaries concerned the owners to the point where they felt that it was going to be in their best interest if they could agree that every contract would include a reserve clause, that a player, even if he did not sign with the team for that next year, could be held in reserve by the team that had last had him under contract, which meant that he could not sign with any other team in organized baseball. Now, this was, as we said, the financial underpinnings of the game for 75 years. It meant that the players had no option whatsoever. If they were going to play professional baseball, they had to play it with the team that held their contract in reserve, unless that team elected to trade or sell that contract. The players were woefully underpaid in these early years. That if you look at the salaries of the 1919 White Sox that were involved in this, Joe Jackson, one of the biggest stars of the game, made $6,000. Eddie Seacott, the best pitcher in the game, made $7,500. Lefty Williams, who won 23 games for the White Sox that year, made $2,500. Even 100 years ago, this was not a lot of money. The salaries in 1919 were further depressed. World War I had really thrown organized baseball into a financial crisis. And there were, you know, a number of reasons for this, but it resulted in the owners looking at the 1919 season, which for a time they wondered if they would even have a 1919 season, that baseball went dark a month early in 1918, and it was not going to resume until the war was over. They didn't expect to play in 1919. After the armistice was signed in November, they hastily convened, agreed they could get a season together in time. But the schedule was cut from 154 to 140 games, and the owners, concerned that attendance was going to be down — it was down during the war year of 1918, convinced the players that salaries had to be depressed. Convinced is probably the wrong word. They told the players that salaries had to be depressed, and they cut just about every player's salary. 1919 proved to be a very good year at the gate, and the owners did not adjust those depressed salaries. So the climate was particularly ripe for this sort of incursion by the gamblers onto the integrity of the game, that the players were a little resentful, a little bit bitter, and suspicious and vulnerable. And that's never a good combination.
You're listening to Reader's Corner, and I'm talking today with Charles Fountain. He is a journalism professor at Northeastern University and the author of The Betrayal, the 1919 World Series and the Birth of Modern Baseball. So let's talk about Chick Gandel, who seems to be at the center of this scandal, and Arnold Rothstein, who seems to be at the other end of the scandal. Tell us about Chick getting this off the ground and how it worked.
Well, there are 1,000 different stories, 1,000 different tellings of the Black Sox story, and they agree on very little except this. Chick Gandel was the guy who put it together. He was the White Sox first baseman. He was a hardscrabble guy that had a tough childhood, had found himself in and out of trouble for his whole life, that his friends were not the kind of people that you were likely to find on the social register in Chicago or anywhere else. And he was friends with a number of gamblers, a number of gambling interests, and he was the guy who recruited the players. He was the guy that put this together. Now, whether he initiated the idea of the fix and brought it to his friends in the gambling world, or whether his friends in the gambling world broached the idea with him and asked if he could recruit the players, we're never going to know the answer to that. That this is really sort of an organic event. I get the sense that there were a lot of conversations that were probably very tentative in the beginning throughout the 1919 season that coalesced near the end of the season. And by the time it coalesced, its origins were lost, probably even to the people who were involved at the time. The other point on which just about every telling of this story agrees is that the money came from Arnold Rothstein, who was New York's most notorious and rakish and best-known gambler, that he was described in the New York newspapers, and he appeared in the New York newspapers about as often as the mayor, Jimmy Walker, did in those years, that he was a popular individual, was seen as sort of a rakish figure. In truth, he was a ruthless gangster with tentacles in every aspect of organized crime. But he was the country's preeminent sporting man, that he made headlines betting and winning big money on horse racing in Belmont and Aqueduct and other tracks, Saratoga. And he's the only guy who could have come up with the money to finance this fix. That all of the other gamblers that were involved in the conversation with the players were small-time operators. There's no way they could have put their hands on the kind of money they were promising the players. The other gamblers that were involved, people from St. Louis and Detroit and Des Moines, Iowa, people that were indicted along with the players when the indictments came out a year after the series, likewise, they were all small-time players. They dreamed of the big time, but they didn't have the money to put something like this over. The one thing that all of these small-time gamblers had in common was a connection to Arnold Rothstein. So the money certainly came from Arnold Rothstein, but he kept himself successfully removed from the fix. That even when the story broke and everyone was pointing their fingers at Arnold Rothstein as the guy who was behind it, Rothstein was able to avoid indictment. That he was masterful at every aspect of being a criminal, even avoiding consequences for his crimes.
How did the legal authorities come upon this fix? In other words, how was it discovered?
Wholly by accident. That the biggest sporting scandal in, professional sports, any sports history, came about entirely by accident. That, as we said, there were rumors surrounding the 1919 World Series, but there had been rumors surrounding half the World Series that had been played to that point, and there were rumors surrounding any number of games during the regular season. So the existence of rumors was not at all unusual. They were almost always dismissed. The reason these were not dismissed was in late August of 1920, the Cubs were set to play a midweek end-of-the-season game, late-season game against the Philadelphia Phillies. The Cubs were in fifth place, and the Phillies, as usual, were in last or next to the last. And Bill Veeck, the father of the man who would later own the Chicago White Sox, Bill Veeck Jr., Bill Veeck, who was president of the Cubs, got a number of telegrams and a number of phone calls saying, watch out for this afternoon's game, the fix is in. So Bill Veeck went to the baseball writers in Chicago. He changed his pitcher. The Cubs lost anyway, but he changed his pitcher to sort of prevent or minimize the chances that the game would be compromised. But he then went to the baseball writers in Chicago and said, investigate this. The baseball writers wrote, this isn't a job for writers, it's a job for the grand jury. The grand jury was then under the control of a man named Charles McDonald, who was interested very much in becoming the next chairman of the National Commission. The National Commission was the three-person body that ruled baseball before the commissioner was hired. It was comprised of the American and National League presidents and a third man chosen from usually the ranks of the owners. But Charles McDonald was someone who very much wanted to be the new chairman of the National Commission. So he went to his friends in the game and asked, would it help my chances if we got involved in investigating the allegations of this rumor about this game fixing? And his friend said, yes, it would. And then the writer said, well, as long as the grand jury is looking into this Cubs-Phillies rumor, why doesn't it look into those rumors that won't go away about last fall's World Series? Charles McDonald came back to Ben Johnson, the American League president, and his friend, saying, will it be in my best interest? Will it enhance my chances of getting the job if I look into this? And Ben Johnson said, absolutely. So that's how the grand jury came to be investigating the Black Sox scandal.
I'm Bob Kustra, host of Reader's Corner, and I'm speaking with Charles Fountain about his new book, The Betrayal. The book tells the story of the 1919 World Series when eight White Sox players were accused of throwing the games to the Cincinnati Reds. And that is where shoeless Joe Jackson comes in, because he also admits it, doesn't he?
He does. He was the second player to confess. Mm-hmm. Both players were assured by Charles Comiskey's attorney that it was not the players that the grand jury was after. It was the gamblers. They wanted the players only as witnesses. It was disingenuous. It would be a wonderful case study for a law school ethics class. But, that was the way business was transacted in that case. That Jackson was the second man to confess. And after his confession to the grand jury, by this time, the story had sort of spread across the city and there was a real crowd outside the courthouse. And as Hugh Fullerton, a reporter for the Herald and Examiner, reported it, as Jackson was leaving the courthouse, one little urchin in Fullerton's telling of it, came up and asked Jackson, "It ain't true, is it, Joe?" And Jackson was said to have replied, "Yes, son, I'm afraid it is." And the boy replied, "Well, I never would have thought it." From that exchange, reported only by Fullerton, we got the "say it ain't so, Joe," that newspapers across the country took that story and ran with it, altered it to the "say" from "it ain't true, is it, Joe," to "say it ain't so, Joe." Historians are very skeptical that that exchange ever took place. Joe Jackson always denied that it had taken place. No reporter other than Hugh Fullerton reported it, and there were a lot of other reporters around at that time. But what I write and what I think is what you alluded to at the opening of the show is it really doesn't matter whether it's true or not. It so encapsulates the story that look at what you've got in three lines. It ain't true, is it, Joe? Yes, son, I'm afraid it is. Well, I never would have thought it. You've got hurt, betrayal. You've got the young boy robbed of his innocence. You've got the nation's great hero stripped of his aura and dignity. That it's really a Shakespearean tragedy in three lines. So it really doesn't matter whether it's true or not. It is what we take and hold from the Black Sox story.
What's fascinating about your book is the way you delve into how the fix is manifested or not manifested on the field. And maybe you could just kind of sum up for us how these players performed on the field, because it wasn't always obvious by the time the series was over whether there was much of a fix going on.
Yeah, that, you know, you can look at a couple of plays in the first two games, the first game that Eddie Seacott pitched, the first game that Lefty Williams pitched, and you could point to a couple of suspicious moments in those plays, a hesitation on a double play, a botched cutoff throw that was actually in a later game, and say, well, were these players trying to lose? But they're the kind of errors that happen in baseball games all the time. The players would later say that they were trying their best throughout the series. And I think that the players were so messed up emotionally as a result of all that was happening, their agreement to throw the World Series, their being double-crossed, which became evident very soon that they weren't going to be paid for their duplicity as they were promised, that they were such emotional wrecks here, I don't think that they were capable of beating a high school team in this World Series. You add that to the fact that Cincinnati played brilliantly. You look at the pitching line of those four Cincinnati starters, it's as good as any group pitching line in World Series history. And they were facing a White Sox lineup where Joe Jackson and Buck Weaver, who were implicated in the fix, but who, you know, both batted well over 300, were in the lineup, as were Hall of Famers Ray Schalk and Eddie Collins. It was a pretty potent lineup, and it played pretty meekly against that Cincinnati pitching. So I think that the Cincinnati players who went to their graves insisting that they were world champions because they were the better team over those 9 days have really gotten sort of short shrift. I think that if the story had not come out in the way that it came out, I doubt very much we would look back and say that there was something suspicious about this series.
And in the meantime, those Black Sox players maintained till their death, many of them, that they really didn't fix the game on the field, regardless of what they did with the gamblers in taking the money. And that gets us to the jury trial and the outcome. Tell us what happens. And then, of course, that's not the last word, because Judge Landis gets the last word here.
Well, the story was really 2 years in unfolding. The series was, of course, in October of 1919. The grand jury did not meet until almost a year later, in September of 1920. The indictments were handed up at the end of the 1920 season. The players were suspended at the end of the 1920 season. The criminal trial did not begin for another full year until June of 1921. In between the indictments and the beginning of the criminal trial, the confessions and the immunity waivers disappeared from the Cook County State's Attorney's Office. The best speculation is that Arnold Rothstein paid a subordinate to pay a person inside the Cook County State's Attorney's Office to have the documents go missing, because this same person ended up with the documents trying to sell them to a New York newspaper a year later. And, there was a lot of legal wrangling on whether or not those statements, on whether copies of those statements were admissible. The trial was delayed. When it was finally held, it was really a compromised trial legally, that the evidence to prove the, as we said, those arcane charges was very slender. And the sympathies with the spectators in the courtroom, I suspect with the jury, was really with the players, that even their teammates, the supposedly betrayed teammates, came in and testified in their defense. And it took the jury only an hour or so to return the not guilty verdict. There were shouts in the courtroom. The players and the jurors were carried from the courtroom on the shoulders of the spectators. They all posed for a picture on the steps of the courthouse at midnight. They all went out and celebrated into the early hours of the morning. And before they were done sleeping it off, Judge Landis had issued his finding. He had stayed very silent during all of this. He was hired in November of 1920, shortly after the indictments came out. He issued his statement where he said, "No ball player whoever agrees to throw a game, nor any ball player who sits in conversation where the means and ways of throwing a game is discussed, will ever play baseball again." And that was the end of the career of those eight players.
Boy, you know, you do a great job, and we don't have time for it here, of in your afterword, where you go in and trace each of these players' lives and how they all worked out. Some worked out okay, some not so well, but what a heavy price to pay. It takes me back to the subtitle of the book, The Birth of Modern Baseball. There is, I guess, something on the wall of every clubhouse in the major leagues, even today, that is a legacy of the Black Sox scandal. Tell us about that, Rule 21.
The game adopted the rule that made it illegal, because just as there were no laws on either the state or federal level preventing the throwing of a baseball game, there were no rules within the game that, certainly implicitly it was there that you would play your best. But there was no explicit rule. That rule was incorporated, and it was posted on the clubhouse walls, and it remains there to this day. That it was posted prominently, and players walked by it every day. Unless they, be tempted, they had Shoeless Joe Jackson and the rest of the Black Sox to remind them. But, you look at today's scandal, you look at performance-enhancing drugs, and really it's, at its core, the exact same story as the Black Sox scandal. The Black Sox were woefully underpaid in those days, and they looked to do whatever they could to make a little extra money, even if it meant cheating. Players today, of course, are obscenely well paid, but still, they want to make sure that they continue to be extremely well paid, and some people are willing to do anything, even cheat, and thus we've got the steroid scandal of the here and now, which in a lot of ways is the same scandal that we had 100 years ago.
Well, that's certainly one of the lessons of your book. And Chuck, I've really enjoyed the interview. This has been a great opportunity to get an inside look at a period of baseball history a century ago. Hard to believe that it's that much of a span of time, but we're just delighted you did the book, delighted you could join us on the show. And I remind our readers that this barely scratched the surface, and you might want to just get a copy of this. It's a great read on the culture of America and the role of baseball in the early 20th century. The name of the book is The Betrayal, The 1919 World Series and the Birth of Modern Baseball. Our guest and author is Charles Fountain. Thanks so much for joining us today at Reader's Corner.
Thanks, Bob. It was a great pleasure and a real privilege.
I hope you enjoyed this encore edition of our interview with Charles Fountain. Next week, Greg Mitchell, author of The Tunnels, Escapes Under the Berlin Wall, and Historic Films the JFK White House Tried to Kill. Reader's Corner is presented by Boise State Public Radio. The engineer for today's show is Eric Jones. Research and production by Janelle Brown. I'm Bob Kustra. Please join me next week as we talk to today's leading writers about the ideas and issues that help shape our world at Reader's Corner.